analysis of the leaders. His book, or he's the one directly recommending that his book is on particularly referred to as anti-memoirs. I would commend it to you, not only for what it tells about China and its leaders, but also about crimes and problems and the whole World War II and post-World War II era. We think, I give you this only to indicate the breadth of the kind of reading that all of us who are going to participate in the talks are trying to undertake. It is very different from the other meetings that we've had at the highest level of the other governments. I have visited with all of the other countries, just not, of course, the Soviet Union. But here, it is essential to do an enormous amount of homework just to come up with a starting line. And I don't want to say that after having read as much as I have and as much as I will be reading between now and the time we arrive, that I will be an expert. But at least I will be familiar with the men we will be meeting and the problems that may be discussed. Tuesday and Wednesday will be used primarily to finish up on many of the domestic matters that are, of course, the subject of matters that I will be discussing with Secretary Connolly and Mr. Burlington over this weekend, and also for further briefings from the members of the NSC staff and the State Department on the China trip. The time of departure is now set will be 10 o'clock. Thursday morning, the 17th, from Andrews. We will fly directly to Hawaii, and we will spend Thursday night and all day Friday in Hawaii. The following morning, Saturday morning, on the 19th, the press plane will go directly to China, launching the Shanghai first and arriving in Peking. The Chinese government is arranging this so that the members of the press can be on the ground prior to the time that I will be arriving. On that same day, Saturday the 19th, the presidential plane, 376, will fly to Guam, and we will overnight in Guam, and then take off the next day, Sunday, for Shanghai and Peking, arriving in Peking Sunday morning, or approximately 10 or 10:30 o'clock Eastern time, U.S. The date, of course, is the 21st there and the 20th here. You know, we've got the international date line on the way. A couple of other points that I know that have been raised in briefings and that I can only cover generally. With regard to agenda, both governments have decided that we will not make any announcements on agenda items prior to the meeting. The agenda will be covered by a joint communique that will be issued at the conclusion of our talks. And consequently, questions on agenda, what will be discussed and so forth, on the part of both sides will not be answered either before we get there or during the course of the meetings, unless the two sides decide while we are meeting that an agenda item can properly be discussed or disclosed. With regard to this itinerary itself, the itinerary generally, as you know, has been announced for three cities. With regard to what we do in each city, it is being kept flexible and no final decisions have been made and none will be announced at this time. Mrs. Nixon's itinerary will be much more public than mine. And she will have an opportunity, which I hope many of you also will have, also earlier, to visit a number of institutions, places of interest here in Beijing, in Shanghai. She having, as you know, traveled to perhaps more countries than the First Lady, looking forward to this with a great deal of interest. And I think she demonstrated in her trip to Africa. Her events, I think, will be worth covering. One side note is that one development in 20th century China that is very significant is the enormous elevation in the status of women. Total equality is now recognized, and looking back over Chinese history, that is, of course, a very significant change. Consequently, I think that Mrs. Nixon's activities will be significant for them. It will be, of course, very significant for us, us in the United States, to see their schools and the other institutions and how they compare to ours and the other countries that we live in. As far as my agenda is concerned, there will not be a great deal of what I would call public sightseeing. There will be some. I would hope to see some of the points of interest, and the Chinese government is arranging for some. But we have both agreed that this visit is one taking place at this time, in which first priority must be given to our talks, and sightseeing and protocols must come second. And consequently, we have agreed that we will not get frozen in to any extended travel within the cities which we will be visiting. In the event that that might interfere with an extended conversation that might be taking place, I do not want to suggest here that the talks, what the length of the talks will be, but necessarily, because we are, in truth, at a beginning, they will be much longer, both with Mr. Joseph and with Mr. Asakon, than with the leaders of other governments that we have visited. Because there, we are not starting from the beginning. We have the opportunity to come immediately to matters of substance. Finally, in order to perhaps put the trip in context, you've heard me discuss it with the various speeches. I haven't really much to add because, as I pointed out, the agenda items will be decided and will be published at the end of our communication. They will be decided at the end of our meetings. In my communication, they will be decided, of course, at the end. But I think we should say this. This trip should not be one which would create very great optimism or very great pessimism. It is one in which we must recognize that 20 years of hostility and virtually no communication will not be swept away by 1 week of discussion. However, it will mark a watershed in the relations between the two governments. The post-war era, with respect to the People's Republic of China, the United States, that chapter now comes to an end at the time that I set foot on mainland China. And a new chapter begins. Now, how the new chapter is written will be influenced, perhaps influenced substantially, by the talks that will take place on our side, and we believe also on their side. We hope that the new chapter will be one of more communication, and that it will be a chapter that will be marked by negotiation rather than confrontation, and one that will be marked by the absence of armed conflict. These are our hopes. We, of course, will now see to what extent those hopes can be realized in this first meeting. I will put any other questions.
It's not relevant to Moses, having said that he is sure that the first question I will ask you is, will you provide aid to China and the direction of the trip will is the test to talk or determine, be determined by your answer. Can you give us any indication that if that is true,
That gets into the area that I will decline to comment upon because it involves the agenda items. I cannot really predict with as much confidence as Izzy Mauro perhaps can as to what Mr. Mazzucano's questions will be. So, consequently, I don't believe it would be proper to comment on a question that has not yet been asked by him. If it is asked, I will have an answer.
Mr. President, you look at the story, you look at the
they will be primarily dialogues. Here is a very subtle, that decision is made between the talks that will take place in the talks that will take place in Moscow. In talks in Moscow, there are certain subjects that we have been negotiating about, and those subjects, therefore, will be negotiated. Of course, there will be dialogue as well. In the case of Ukraine, there will necessarily have to be a substantial amount of dialogue before we can come to the point of negotiating on substantive matters. I should emphasize, too, that as it's already been pointed out by Dr. Fisher when he returned, that we speak of these matters is that they will be primarily bilateral matters. Beyond that, however, I will not go.
Mr. President, Mr. Haldeman has had very strong words for critics of your peace proposal, saying that it they're consciously aiding and abetting the enemy. Your statement was somewhat softer. The Democrats do not seem to feel it's enough. But do you think that Mr. Haldeman's statement, he's so close to you, and a lot of people interpret his thinking is very close to yours, should be left to lie as it is, or is there something further that you should say?
There's nothing further that I should say. I think Mr. Ziegler covered the situation. Sorry, Mr. Haldeman. You ladies and gentlemen pressed me very hard on Monday. I stated my position very clearly yesterday in my summary of the State of the World speech. We have here a situation where there is a difference of opinion among various candidates for the presidency as to how they should conduct themselves at this time. As I pointed out, I consider it a matter of judgment. I do not question the patriotism. I do not question the sincerity of the people who disagree with me. Because a lot of people disagree with me on this and other issues as well. Perhaps to put it in clear context, I was a very vigorous critic of the policies that got us into Vietnam. I was a critic, for example, of the settlement which resulted in the partition of Laos, which opened the Ho Chi Minh Trail and paved the way for the invasion of the South by the Army of the Americans. I was a critic of the policies and the actions, which I think most observers would agree contributed to the assassination of Diem and the succession of coups, which then brought on further armed conflict. I was a strong critic of the conduct of the war before I was a candidate and after I was a candidate. But once I became a candidate and once President Johnson announced he would no longer be a candidate and the peace talks began, I said then that there, as far as I was concerned, as a man seeking the presidency, I would say nothing that would in any way jeopardize those peace talks. So there is, in my view, and I do not ask others to hold it, I have to consider, there is, in my view, a very great difference between criticizing policies that got us into war and criticizing the conduct of war and criticisms by a presidential candidate of a policy to end the war and to bring peace. And what we have here is a situation, as Secretary Rogers pointed out, a situation where within 1 week after a very forthcoming peace proposal was made, various presidential candidates saw fit to propose another settlement that went beyond that. My own candid judgment is that that kind of action has the effect, as I implied in my remarks yesterday, it has the effect of having the government in Hanoi consider at least that they might be well advised to wait until after the election.
You have any
rather than negotiate. And so my view is that, as far as I was concerned, that is why I did not criticize when I was a candidate for president. After President Johnson started the negotiations, I thought it was good judgment then. As far as others are concerned, they have to consult their own consciences. They apparently have determined that they wish to take another course of action. I disagree with the course of action. And I would strongly urge that at this point, that all candidates for president, Republican and Democrat, review their public statements and really consider whether they believe they're going to help the cause of peace or courage, whether they're going to encourage the enemy to negotiate or encourage him into the war. I have stated my position very categorically. It is different from others. I respect the other opinions. You'll have to let people judge what is right.
Mr. President, is there real flexibility in this country on the question of when President Tu should resign? And is flexibility in Saigon? Is there a real difference? And are you going to do anything about it?
Well, I noticed the flap that has occurred that President Tu said today, and based on his interpretation of what Secretary Rogers had said. I think the misunderstanding can be cleared up by what I now say. Every proposal we have made in Paris has been a joint proposal by the government of South Vietnam and the government of the United States. Every proposal that we have made has been after consultation with and after receiving suggestions from the government of South Vietnam as well as the government of the United States. The best example of that is the proposal that I announced from January 25th to the Senate on October 11th. The offer on the part of President Tu to resign a month before the election was his idea. And we included it in the proposal. It was a very, in my opinion, a very statesmanlike thing for him to do, and showed his devotion to the proposition of trying to find a way to break the political deadlock, which is deadlocked beyond the law. Now, at this point, I can say that any future proposals we make will be joint proposals of the government of South Vietnam and the government of the United States. As far as we are concerned, we have made an offer. It is forthcoming. Many have said it's as far as we can go. We are ready to negotiate on that offer. We and the government of South Vietnam. But under no circumstances are we going to make any further proposals without the consultation with and the agreement of the government of South Vietnam, particularly on political issues, because the political issues are primarily there to decide right now. And I would say also that under no circumstances are we going to negotiate with our ally in a way that undercuts our ally. We're not going to negotiate over the heads of our ally with our enemies to overthrow our ally. As I said in my speech on January 25th, we are ready to negotiate a settlement, but we're not going to negotiate a surrender either for the United States nor are we going to negotiate the surrender of 15 million people of South Vietnam to the communists. So as far as President Chu and his government is concerned, our government is concerned, the proposal that we have made is a joint proposal. If there are to be any changes in that proposal, and we don't intend to make any, unless and until there is some indication that the enemy intends to negotiate in good faith, it will be a joint proposal. The next step is up to the enemy. Our proposal is on the table, and it's going to stand there until we get a reply from
the President. President, you have said in the past that if the Democrats hope to make any decision in power, that you would pull the rug would be pulled out from under them. Do you feel that that issue now remains a live issue, and are you disappointed that it is that it does still remain part of the public dialogue in so intense a way?
Well, I'm very disappointed that the enemy has refused to negotiate. And as you know, have always pointed out that we have a two-track approach to ending the American involvement. Our favorite track is negotiation. That could have ended it. 69, 70, 71, we made various proposals with the basis for negotiation. The longer track is Vietnamization. That will end the American involvement in a predictable time, as I think most of us can see. As far as pulling the rug out from under those who critically criticize, and it's not a partisan issue, there are Republicans as well as Democrats who have disagreements. I respect those disagreements. As far as pulling the rug out is concerned, I would say that I think any American would be delighted to have their rug pulled out from under on this issue if it brings peace and an end to the killing. That's what we're trying to do. And I would hope that presidential candidates particularly would consult their consciences before they make proposals, which might be misread, might be. They would not intend to be sure, but might be misread by the enemy, and thereby encourage them to wait until after the election before even discussing a very forthcoming proposal.
Mr. President, why are you not, sir, holding news conferences with very much regularity? And what in particular do you have against televised news conferences? I believe it's been more than 8 months.
Well, I will hold news conferences whenever I believe that they will serve the public interest. And as far as televised news conferences are concerned, I find that the ladies and gentlemen in the press corps have a very vigorous difference of opinions, for which is the more valuable forum. I remember the last time, or a few months ago, that I was in this office. One of the first time I had an in-office conference daily with a White House correspondent said this is the best time to press conference. I'm sure Mr. Radler thinks the best time is one of him alone. So I will have Q&A with one commentator. I had questions and answers with some members of the press, as you know, alone. I will have in-office press conferences. Sometimes I walk out to the room there, and as I did when I announced the COVID summit, and had the press conference in the room there, where the press room, so that whoever wants to make comment, and on other occasions we may have a televised press conference. I would only say finally, with regard to the televised press conference, it is no more work than one like this. But I would suggest that I do follow the columns and the commentators pretty well. And I noted that there was considerable, I would call it criticism, but eyebrow raising with regard to why has the president been on television so much. He had a day in the life of the president, and that took an hour of prime time. He had a half hour the night before CBS. And then he had an hour with Radley, another CBS. And then he had a State of the Union message, and he had a prime time for the purpose of making an announcement of Vietnam, in addition to all the rest. Let me say, I think television has probably had as much of the president as it wants at this point, and that's why you're getting this kind of comments.
We had some public advice today and yesterday about how critics of the Washington Metro themselves. Do you
but do you plan to consult with him early, at some early point to see this meeting?
We already have. We're in constant consultation. I discussed the matter with Ambassador. President Chu knows first, based, as he said, is on the statement, because if you'll read it carefully, he pointed out that these guys we have consulted. First, that we have never made a proposal, except when it was a joint proposal. He knows now there will be no new proposals made, except when it is, unless it is a joint proposal. And I trust that this press conference that I'm having now with you, ladies and gentlemen, will reassure not only him, but the people of South Vietnam as well on that point. As far as flexibility is concerned, Secretary Rogers was referring to was what we have always said, that we have put a proposal on the table. We're ready to negotiate on it. Now, that does not mean, however, that after having made such a proposal, that 2 weeks later, we're going to go a step further and say that we'll go further than we have in that proposal. At this point, I emphasize here today, we have made a proposal. We think it is reasonable. The enemy has not responded to it. Until the enemy does respond to it, there will be no further proposals and no further concessions on our part.
Mr. President, you spoke in your foreign policy report about sympathy for the aspirations of the East Bengali people. Could you give us some idea of the factors and perhaps the timing of the decision on the recognition of Bangladesh?
Well, with regard to the problem of the Bengali people, first, let me say, on the humanitarian society, both before the war, during the war, and after the war, the United States has been the most generous of all the nations. We will continue to be. That's separate from the political side. With regard to the political side, we have understudied our whole relationship with the subcontinent. And as part of that relationship, of course, the 70 million people in Bangladesh are involved. But we have not yet made a decision with regard to recognition, we do not, we should not expect a decision prior to the time that I return from China.
Mr. President, what are your views on the constitutional amendments on busing now before the House of
Representatives? Which one?
The amendments have to do with
busing. There are several. Let me get out of this particular. My views on busing are well known. I favor the neighborhood school. I favor local control local schools. I oppose busing for the purpose of racial balance. Those are my views, which are the statement. The problem we have now is that some courts have handed down decisions which are seen to differ from those views. And so the question arises as to whether legislation or a constitutional amendment is necessary if we are to see that those views that I have just enunciated can properly be held and implemented. Because if the courts, acting under the Constitution, decide that the views that I have held are unconstitutional, I, of course, will have to follow the courts. Under these circumstances, therefore, I have ordered a study of the legislative route and of the constitutional amendments. And as part of that study, I have asked that Senator Brown and Senator Baker in the Senate, and Congressman Speed, and Congressman Len in the House come to the White House on Monday for the purpose of discussing their amendment. The purpose is discussion to see whether the constitutional amendment approach is the best approach to this problem. After I have met Monday, I will be glad to have Mr. Zager review on what the next step is. completed. I have not made a decision on it, but the matter is under consideration.
Mr. President, what is it in your position on civil suits filed in the names of immigrants by neighborhood legal services lawyers against local and state governments? Is that a legitimate function of neighborhood legal services officers?
I'm not going to get into that at this point.
Mr. President, another congressional matter, you've been receiving strong suggestions from the Democrats and others on tax reform programs. How do you intend to respond?
I didn't hear.
How do you intend to respond
to the first part of the question?
The proposals for tax reform that you've been suggesting, you said program tax reform that employers and Democrats have to respond.
Well, first, there will be no increase in taxes this year. It is obvious that even if the administration were to recommend tax reform this year, it would be impossible for the Congress, particularly the Ways and Means Committee, as much as it has on display, and the Finance Committee, to welfare reform and revenue sharing and rest every year. So there will be no tax increase this year. Second, I pointed out in the State of the Union message that we are studying the problem of the property tax. We're studying it first because it is the most regressive of all taxes, and second, because in those states, and that's most of the states, where the property tax is the primary source for financing public education, recent court decisions indicate it may be unconstitutional. Under these circumstances, that's why I've asked the McElroy Commission and the Commission on Intergovernmental Relations to study this problem as to how general tax reform might be undertaken, which would meet the objections to the property tax and perhaps mitigate the inequities and find another source of revenue to replace it. That would come to we have not recommended the value-added tax, and at the present time, it is one of a number of proposals being considered by the Treasury Department, by the Domestic Council, and the others with responsibility, as part of a general tax reform. But one point that should be made is this. The property tax is regressive. In the event that we finally decide, after hearing from these two commissions, that tax reform is necessary for the future, and it will have to be next year, not this, we're certainly not going to replace one regressive tax with another regressive tax. That's why, when we discussed value added, and Secretary Connolly and I have had a long discussion about this just 2 days ago, and we're going to discuss it again in Florida tomorrow, along with other problems of that type, when we discuss value added, it can't even be considered unless the formula can be found to remove its regressive features if you had it across the board. I don't know whether such a formula can be found. But to sum up, we have made no decision with regard to a value added tax. At the present time, we have not yet found the way, frankly, that we could recommend it to replace the property tax. But with the obligation to face up to the need to reduce or reform property taxes, the Treasury Department necessarily is considering other methods of taxation. And I emphasize again, there will be no new taxes this year. And second, whenever any tax reform is recommended by this administration, it will not be one which will replace one form of regression with another form of regression. It will not be one that increases the tax burden for the mayor. It will be one that simply reforms it and makes it more affordable.
Mr. President, we haven't had a press conference with you for 3 months. I wonder if we could have one or two more questions.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
I would like to ask asking the question about the statements that were made by administration officials during the India-Pakistan War. Mr. Kissinger told us during that war that this administration had no bias toward India. Subsequently, papers came to light, according to Mr. Kissinger, saying that he was getting help from you every half hour because the government wasn't because the government wasn't tilting enough toward Pakistan.
Colleagues.
Right. I'm wondering, from a credibility standpoint, how do you reconcile these two things?
I remember being in this office, what I think was one of the saddest days of President Eisenhower's presidency. At the time, he had come out against the British, the French, and the Israelis in the Suez Crisis. He did so because we were against the war. Not because we were anti-British, anti-French, or anti-Israeli. As a matter of fact, we were pro-British, and pro-French, and pro-Israeli. But we were against war more. Now, as far as India is concerned, for 25 years, and those of you who have followed me in the House will know this, as a member of the House, as a member of the Senate, as Vice President, while I was out of office and now as President, I have supported every Indian aid program too. I believe it is very important for the world's largest non-communist country to have a chance to make a success of its experiment in democracy in comparison with its great neighbor to the north, which is the world's largest communist country. That and, of course, other reasons, of course, involved. But as far as being anti-Indian is concerned, I could only say I was anti-war. We did everything that we could to avoid the war, as I pointed out. And at this point, we're going to do everything that we can to develop a new relationship with the countries in the subcontinent that will be pro-Indian, pro-Bengali, pro-Pakistan, but mostly pro-peace. That's what that part of the world needs. 1 million were killed in the War of Partition. That's probably a modest figure. And then they went through the terrible agony again in 1965, and now they've gone through it again. And it was Prime Minister Nehru who told me that more than anything else, what the subcontinent needed was a generation of peace. That's where I got the phrase. Now, as far as we were concerned, I believe that our policies, certainly they made mistakes, but our policies have the purpose of avoiding the war, stopping it once it began, and now are doing everything we can to heal up the wounds.
Mr. President, discovered, sir, who was the source of the papers that were leaked to Mr. Anderson, and then planning any action against that person, if you know who it is?
Well, first, we have a lot of circumstantial evidence. Second, as a lawyer, I can say that we do not have evidence that I consider adequate or that the Attorney General considers adequate to take to court. You can be sure that the investigation is continuing. If the investigation gets a break, which provides the kind of evidence which will stand up in court, we will present it. But we cannot go to court on circumstantial evidence.
Mr. President,
you discussed the your stand in 1968 in regard to the peace negotiations. We know now that there was really very little possibility. As a matter of fact, you know it now. I said it then, over and over again, those who had to listen to my speech. I only had one in 1968, you recall, but many of them that's what you wrote it. But I pointed out that I thought there was very little chance. But I said, as long, and this was my phrase, just read it this morning, as long as there was any chance whatever that, and I could not be sure because I wasn't being consulted, for a breakthrough at the peace table, I was going to say nothing that might destroy that chance. Now that was my view, it made him wrong.
Could I take it closer?
Sure, it was different to any way you want.
As a consequence of your position in 1968, you were promising to end the war, but because of the negotiations that were going on, you felt yourself unable to tell the American people how you proposed to do it once elected president.
Now it is almost 4 years since these negotiations, in a way, began with President Johnson's announcement of March 31st, 1968. Do you think that under these circumstances, it is fair to the American people and to your driver and to this nation for those who seek the highest office and who have been from the war not to say how they would proceed if they were to become the next president? All the candidates for the presidency have a right to say what they want. They must determine whether they believe it is right to say it. I concluded in 1968 that as one who was a potential president, and that was particularly true after I received the nomination, that while I had a right to criticize, it was not right to do so. Now, each of these candidates may feel that the peace proposal that we have made is one that they don't think goes far enough. They may feel that we should make one that would overthrow the government of South Vietnam, or some other proposal that will satisfy the enemy. They have a right to say that. The American people then will have to judge. But I am suggesting now that we have made a proposal that is fair, it is forthcoming, it should be negotiated on, and the responsibility for the enemies failing to negotiate may have to be borne by those who encourage the enemy to wait until after the election.
Mr. Secretary,